This is Hilary Spira, one of the cinematographers of Daredevil Born Again.
This is Pedro Gomez Milan, another cinematography of Daredevil Born Again.
And this is the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey, Ilya. How's it going?
Hey, Ben, I'm doing just fine.
So, Ilya, who do we have on the show today?
We have the we have a duo of DPs from the new television series Daredevil.
Yeah, it is Hilary Spira and Pedro Milan. Hilary is the lead DP. She shot, I believe, all but two of the episodes. And Pedro, like, we talk a lot about how they collaborate, like basically how Pedro takes the correct cues from her and they share ideas and collaborate. They have a show like Daredevil that is a phenomenal looking show, by the way, just phenomenal. It was interesting to talk to her because I just so happened to have watched The French Connection like a week before we did this interview. And she talked about how The French Connection was like one of the landmark references for their look.
And what a great movie. Yeah. Fantastic. Gene Hackman.
Freaking well, yeah. One of the best. Yeah. I think I was watching it because it was like right after Gene Hackman died and I just kind of had Gene Hackman on the mind and I'm like, you know, I hadn't seen that movie in a long time and it's so great. Anyway, her kind of talking about how she kind of based the look on that. This show has, like, if you're a fan of the original Daredevil and kind of the crazy oneers they did, you're going to love this show. The first episode has, I think, one of the most explosive oneers they've ever done for a giant fight scene. And it's just great. So it was great to talk to the two of them.
It sounds awesome. I haven't gotten to see the show. I haven't gotten to hear the interview. So I've got lots of stuff to look forward to. I'm looking
forward
to it.
Yeah, catch up. What are you doing? wait, Ilya, are you telling me that both of us don't watch literally everything? Both of us don't watch everything that we have on here.
You know what? When we divide and conquer. You know, sometimes it is impossible for the amount of stuff that you and I go through. And it is a weekly podcast. We've been doing this for a long time. And I love to catch up and I love to listen to your interviews and I love to see the stuff that you got to see and hear about it because, you know, we have our on-camera conversation about it, but we also typically have an off-camera, you know, outside the podcast conversation too. And sometimes I know that, like, when you are talking about something on the show and you really like it, that sometimes doesn't even do it justice because you like it so much more than you actually said that you liked it. And then it's like, you're like, no, you got to reshuffle your order. You got to watch this one. This is the thing that you got to spend your time with, and which I really appreciate it. And in fact, actually, as long as I hate to use the Gen Z logo of spilling the tea, but as long as we're going on a little bit, did that offend you?
You know, it's like when we were kids and John Hughes would always make those movies where, like, dads who are actually probably younger than both of us are now,
for sure,
but like we're like trying to use the cool lingo of the of you know, Ferris Bueller or
sure,
whatever,
yeah,
and it just never
it doesn't
quite
sound right. Yeah, so going behind the scenes a little bit here, you know, we're talking a little bit about the stuff that goes on, you know, that people don't usually have access to for the podcast.
And now, Close Focus.
And actually, I think our Close Focus falls right into this. You know, our Close Focus is a viewer, listener comment. And the comment is really, really good. Ben, I've got it pulled up, but do you have a choice? Do you want to read the comment? You want me to read the comment?
It's from Timo W. Oberman. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Hi, guys. I've really been enjoying the show, but recently I was listening to your episode with Lal Crawley on The Brutalist, and I don't remember if it was one of you guys or him, but somebody went along the lines of, let's not get too technical here. I just wanted to say, where else should DPs get technical? It's always the same big picture philosophical approach in every interview. Excuse me.
If there are three podcasts or articles about a movie, they're covering at least 60% of the same ground, which I get is normal and fine, but please encourage DPs to get technical and in depth.
Especially if it's a movie shot on film. If they say, we underexposed and pushed the film, you can ask, what did you rate the film at and how much did you push? Technical choices are informed by the big picture philosophical stuff, but it also really helps understanding the big picture philosophical stuff with what specific technical choices were made to enable that. Good point.
It's a great question. And we have had this same conversation internally a number of times over the years. In the past, there was always usually another place that someone could go if they really did want to get more technical. And American Cinematographer was a good choice for that. And
still is.
Still is. And
yeah.
I didn't really feel the need just to, you know, redo what somebody else was doing like that, especially because there's a lot of people out there who their eyes glaze over the moment you start using a number. Their eyes glaze over as soon as you talk about, you know, tab A and slot B connecting. They glaze over as what... I remember being at Sundance one year, and someone asked the question of what camera a movie was shot on, and the person directly in front of me said, "Who cares?" really, really loudly. And sure enough, there's a lot of people who do care. Our audience cares. Cinematographers care. This is an important, informative thing that you know, they want to understand the tech, because this is the mixture of artistic and technical. But there are a few really good reasons also why we don't go down deep into the technical rabbit hole. Because, I'm just going to lay it out right here. Timo, you are in the minority. You and I and many of the other people out there who actually really do want to go into all the technical stuff are the you know, there's a small number of us. And that information is available typically even outside of the podcast. You can find that information. You can actually also email me or send me a message, because like, there's a good chance I'll know that information. I'm happy to share it. And maybe we'll start putting maybe a text notes maybe in the show notes. Maybe we'll start, like, it doesn't make the show, but we'll put it there. So if people want to go to the website, and then they could look up and actually get some of the more technical stuff. Now, granted, talking about film and talking about film tech in particular is a little bit more, you know, outside of the mainstream today, and also stays a lot more consistent. It's not the same as something that changes every like 3 months. And frankly, when people start going into the magic of some sort of technology, or Ben, when we were talking beforehand off camera, a particular LUT, that dates really fast. People don't necessarily...
I mean, the whole camera does. If you say I was shooting on a Sony Venice, great. But in 5 years' time, that will be relatively meaningless. And I guess, like, when I read this message from Timo, that was sort of... That was I because I did the interview with Lal, and I kind of feel like, you know, it's a little bit... I always tell DPs, we don't get into this, and we don't get into the nuts and bolts of the high tech stuff. If it's part of your story, feel free to talk about it, but don't feel like you have to tell me every little, you know, like you said, tab A into slot B kind of thing. That being said, I actually feel like film is kind of an evergreen topic, because, you know, like shooting on film, like now it's super trendy to shoot VistaVision. I saw the trailer for the new P.T. Anderson movie, and the last title card said shot in VistaVision. Mm. I'm like, yeah. Holy crap. Yep. We're in a full blown
VistaVision revival
of a trend. I'm very happy about that. Yeah. But like, you know, yeah, pushing the film, how many stops, processing it, you know, force processing it, or whatever you do that's kind of funky processing, that stuff remains the same. I always think, like, when we started this podcast, I, as an avid reader of American Cinematographer for decades, there are articles that would really engage me, and there are articles that would lose me. And the ones that lost me were the ones where they would, as like, you know, generally someone who finds myself on the low budget indie scale, anyone who's like, yeah, you know, we filled up a football field with 700 dyno lights and we had, you know, 16 different, you know, dimmer system board, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't need to hear that. That's not relevant information that will be of any use to any filmmaker. And I was always interested with like someone saying, like, I remember in the 12 Monkeys article about talking about putting black pantyhose behind the lens and how they tested white pantyhose and black pantyhose and stuff like that. And I'm like, pantyhose, that's a technology I can easily play with you can, and try out.
Yes. And you can absolutely understand the relevance. And ultimately what we're trying to do is satisfy a broad group of people who listen to this podcast. But there's one other group of people that we really actually want to not get too technical with. And that is DPs. There's actually quite a few DPs out there who consider themselves fully non-technical, like non-technical. Granted, quite a few of them know plenty of information and are technical, but they don't consider themselves very technical. They employ highly technical people on their team. I myself have been hired in the past to be other people's technical, you know how to get, you know, to make sure they get things done. There are quite a few DPs in Hollywood, ASC members, who get hired when it gets too complex for the headline DP whose name is on the project. I'm not saying, you know, who these people are or what the scenarios always are. But
honestly, we've had DPs on here who we would say, what lens did you use? And they're like, oh, I just let the first AC choose the lens. We've had prominent major DPs tell us that. And it's like, I feel like that person is not going to look at it and have no opinion about the glass. They're going to put the lens on and they're going to be like, that's not right. Let's try something else.
Look,
They're not. And to me, like lens and like basic lighting, that's the bare minimum that they're all doing. But how they get there is how they get there. They all get there differently. And almost to a person, when I tell people we don't get into the nut meat of the high tech stuff, almost all of them is like, oh, thank God.
Yes, there's a relief. And I will say there's quite a few DPs who have come on the show who have been like, I don't want to go down that path, or I don't have the answers to that. They employ people who can make those decisions, and they can speak, you know, flowery and philosophically of like what the theme is or what's supposed to be happening. And they can recognize it when they see it of what's going on. But, you know, getting from, you know, point A to point B, there's a lot of different ways. There's 9 different ways to make, you know, to make what happened, you know, from the beginning to the end result. And sometimes there's probably a lot more than that. And ultimately it comes down to, do you trust your team? How quickly can people work? Are you getting the advantages? Mm. Now, I personally believe that the absolute best DPs are a mixture of plumber and artist, and they have the technical know-how to be.
That's what you've been saying from the beginning. That's the question you would ask people.
That's exactly how this show started off. That was my number one question. There are people out there who are all artists, and there are people out there who are all plumber. And if you're all one or all the other, it makes it very, very difficult for you to get your job done from the logistical standpoint of actually, you know, lighting a shot, following your action, making sure that things cut together. You have to have a little bit. And, you know, people come up in different ways. They come up through the lighting department. They come up through the camera department. Some people just emerge from film school fully formed. I'm a DP. And then there are other people who've had no formal training. And then they've decided that this is their path in life. We have talked to all of those types of people here. We've talked to all of them.
And it's not like they're like, if there's one thing I can say, there is, after doing this now for what, 12 years, there isn't one path to being great at this. There isn't one. I can't look at it and say, oh, someone who was trained in a film school or someone who worked in the camera department or someone who worked in the lighting department is going to be better than another one. That, like, the people we have on here are all people who have accomplished some level of something. Many of them are Oscar winners, you know, they're or working at the highest levels. And and Lal Crawley, after that interview, went on to win the Oscar. So, I think it's because of the interview. I think our interview is what kind of pushed him over the edge there.
Absolutely. We should take 100% of the credit for that.
Yeah, yeah.
But really, no, in all seriousness, though, there is something to be said about the irrelevance of the technology. Like, I am a technical person. I do technical things all day long. But what trumps technology is empathy. What trumps technology is story. What trumps technology is the emotional connection that you get when you sit down and you watch something. And at the end of the day, then, what brand of lens or what brand of camera or what LUT was applied is completely irrelevant to your experience as an audience member. It's very relevant to the people whose job it is who make those things and everything else. And you might be really interested in that. And I relate. I totally relate. But end of the day, the thing that is most important is what people experience and what sort of emotions and feelings they get from it. So, empathy is going to trump technology every single day.
All right. Well, I think that's great. And thank you very much for your email. Keep them coming. And, we're happy to talk to you further about this, too. And honestly, I don't disagree. I think it probably would have been cool to get more info about the film technology. And as I suspect, we're going to have more and more people who shoot film coming on. I will personally make a greater effort to do that. So thank you for reaching out to us.
Timo, it's a great question. And it's really why we wanted to. Thank you for writing in it. And if other people out there have questions and want to write in or comments and whatnot, we're pretty easy to get a hold of. There's a lot of different ways. So, and our producer.
Yeah, we'll talk to anybody. Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Anyway, Ben, we should get to the interview.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Let's start with just how the two of you ended up on the show. Who ended up on the show first? Did you have a pre-existing relationship before then? All that good stuff.
Yeah, I ended up there first. We started, I think, in 2022, actually, sort of in the fall of 2022.
Mid-pandemic.
I know, right? Yeah, it was definitely still pandemic times. Yeah, I don't think we knew each other beforehand. I knew we had a lot of friends in common because Pedro was in New York working right before he went to L.A. So we have a lot of, like, camera crew and stuff in common, but we had not met. So this is our first collaboration, which was super cool.
Yeah, same. I was it was the first time working with Marvel, and they sent me a project before this, and it didn't work out, but I was happy to jump on board with this with Hillary. That was super, super exciting.
So I was a big fan of the original Daredevil series that aired on Netflix like 10 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been 10 years. And picking up a show that already has kind of a look that was baked into it and a pre-existing fan base, my first question would be, how much did you have to pay deference to the original way that the show looked? How did you want to build on how the show looked and turn it into your own thing? Or did you not even pay attention to how the original show looked and just build your own new thing from the ground up?
The original show was, it's iconic. I mean, they did such a great job. It's so popular. I mean, the Warners alone are yeah, absolutely some of the most famous stuff that I think Marvel's done, TV for sure, all of the genre. So certainly aware of it, but I think the goal was to sort of bring it to a more, like to evolve it, you know, to bring it to a more cinematic realm. It's 10 years after post, so you know, we decided to do anamorphic. We decided to sort of make it feel a little more elevated and cinematic, but also kind of more grounded. Like they did a lot of noir stuff, which is certainly in our language as well, but I think, like, you know, some of the 70s films were really a huge reference for us. Like French Connection was kind of our North Star.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in there. Taxi Driver, of course, you know, The Conversation, Friends of Eddie Coyle. It could go on and on. I mean, that's sort of my favorite genre, or my favorite era of filmmaking. But so that was a big reference, and it was important to us to kind of keep it human and then also have these comic book moments that really obviously shine and are very much part of the story and the genre. So it sort of is all in the same conversation visually, I feel, but maintaining those themes, but bringing it forward and kind of seeing how we could, like, bring it into the current realm.
And Hillary, you also brought Dexter back, right? Like you shot Dexter the New Blood, which I was a huge fan of the original series and was so excited to see the New Blood. And I was interested to see too that, like, partially just because of the location it was set in, they didn't feel like they needed to look the same. It didn't look like Miami in the New Blood because they were, I forget where, but it was a snowy place like up north somewhere. Did any of that inform, did any of the Dexter experience inform your approach to this?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm joking that I've been in like a reboot world because I also did the reboot of The Craft. And so it's sort of just like a funny realm that we all are working in these days. But, yeah, I mean, the thing that I know first and foremost is that the fans really lead it, you know, and building something that the fans are going to feel proud of and that, you know, serve the original, but also like bring something new, I think is critical. In terms of New Blood, like, we were in upstate New York in this story, but we shot in Massachusetts, and, you know, just making a world that felt right for that, which was colder, it was not Miami, it was not poppy. So, you know, I think, like, it's the same approach. It's just, it's seeing what the story is now and finding a visual style that really fits it, you know?
And, in terms of collaboration between the two of you, so, you know, we've obviously on this podcast, we've talked to series that were entirely shot by the same DP. We've talked to series that were shot by, you know, over however many seasons, you know, numerous DPs. But I'm curious about the collaboration between the two of you. Like, how much do you collaborate? Because and also, like, I'm assuming you alternated, but I don't know. How did you break up the episodes as you did them?
Well, Block One originally, I mean, it's known that there was a pre and post strike moment. So we started with Block One. Hillary just shot the pilot and episode two, and I follow up with was at that time episode 3 and 4, and then she continued with 5 and 6 until we got stopped by the strike. And after that, we came back, And it was like a new direction on the show, a new, you know, rewrites. So Hillary reshot the pilot, and then the episodes kind of like, I guess they got bumped, right? Like there was a new pilot. So
you reshot the pilot? The whole pilot got reshot?
Yeah, what was originally the pilot in the second episode became 2 and 3, and then the pilot's new. Yes, everything kind of shifted down one.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. So they just made an episode that was like the prequel to episode one as you'd already shot it.
Exactly, and definitely rewrites, as Pedro's saying. You know, there's a lot of additional stuff that they added in to sort of rework the storyline, and we never got to the original final two episodes. Those were rewritten entirely, so that's what we ended up, you know, after the strike, coming back and doing.
So you guys got the worst of it because you had COVID, you started in COVID, and then you hit the strikes, and then you got shut down and came back. I know it's maybe more of a writer question, but like, what prompted the rewrites? Was it that they put together the material that they had and said, oh, we need to change X, Y, Z, and then they kind of had to retcon that? And because that episode one is, I thought it was an amazing episode, and actually, you know, kind of ends with what I think of as, you know, one of the iconic Daredevil fights. Like that fights, that scene is that one that you did is just unbelievable. And I can't, as you're telling me this, it's kind of blowing my mind because I can't imagine starting in the next episode. Was it kind of amalgamated out of that, or like how did story wise how did that work?
I mean, Dario Scarlett Payne, who did, you know, who came on as showrunner, was genius in the way that he was able to jigsaw puzzle together. I mean, originally, we can both speak to the fact that, you know, it was a lot more courtroom. It was a lot more about Matt as a lawyer. And I think what they did is they realized, you know, through watching the material, and we had the benefit of having the strike time to sort of review, which nobody sort of gets that opportunity. I think they looked at it and they were like, you know, let's reshift and kind of reorient and maybe bring forward the Daredevil aspect of Matt earlier. So that was a big change. And then moving forward, you know, it's sort of, it definitely had elements of what we originally set out to do. I think it was just sort of reshifted and, you know, Punisher was brought in, which was really exciting and things like that. So
it was a great cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Episode 5? And
also, you...
Oh, really? Is that your favorite? Oh, I didn't know series, that.
Which is the next one. Oh. So, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Interesting, because when we were on set, Charlie said, like, oh, this is, I mean, he I don't know, he was talking about the episode, and he was like, probably fans are probably going to love this. This is like, you know, a bottle episode, which premiered next week. And then I think it ranked super, super high, you know, with these focus groups that they do. It was like the highest episode ranked ever or something, and we're like... And to me, that was not my favorite episode. You know, it was a different one that you shot. But I was like, I guess people like that. I don't know. We'll see.
It's hard to choose. I mean, they're all super fun in different ways. You know, like I really love last week's episode 4. You know, the stuff with Punisher is amazing, and bringing in Muse is so cool. So, yeah, it was really neat how they were able to maintain the structure and move the story forward, but also use what we had done before, not throw that away entirely, and work it all in. It's kind of incredibly magical that was able to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it feels so cohesive. I mean, like, you know, episodic is really hard to kind of get an episode dialed in exactly structurally right, than to like cut it up and rejigger it sounds extraordinarily difficult.
No, yeah, I was just saying, like, you know, you were bringing up collaboration between both of us, and it was like, you know, it was nice because Hillary was like, you know, shooting 1 and 2 and letting me know, hey, you know, this is a little bit what's happening, and giving me some heads up. I remember I was still in LA on a different show, and we're like, you know, we set up some phone calls, and she will fill me in, like, what was going on. And I remember the nights coming back to me when, you know, when that originally first episode, but also like coming back, and we're all always kind of like bouncing off ideas, like, you know, for example, like going into Matt's office, you know, like all these different looks, and maybe a rain look, and you know, we don't want it to look all the same. So what can we do to make it better? And at the same time, like a lot of, like, you know, after the rewrites, much of what we shot got all kind of like mixed together. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised, and it's also like a team effort of like how everything looks cohesive and looks like the same show. And that's the point, you know, it's not, it's just about being a kind of like a team player, and executing that one single vision that everybody's on board.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. I mean, I'm really proud of that, too, how it all feels like the same, you know, the same long movie, ideally, and we're all making the same thing. And yeah, I mean, collaboration's definitely the most fun part of it. It's like we're only as good as who we get to work with and ideas that come forth, you know, and I think that that's so cool. And yeah, one thing I think we really did collaborate on a lot, and it was one of our challenges, was the sensory stuff and, you know, just trying to find ways to show that we're trying to represent a visual thing that something visually that's not visual. So it was fun to kind of put our heads together on that and see what worked and what didn't work. And we extensively tested it, and we're just always kind of in conversation and seeing what either one of us could bring to the table as we like evolved it, you know, forward as well. So it was cool.
Yeah, I like that, because there was also like, you know, not just the sensory stuff, but like memory flashbacks, and it just. You know, and also Aaron and Justin and you, you guys brought in like the big sensory grander, like that, like big zoom, which works so well in that those specific moments. Like, and if you go through the show, there's a variety of tools to tell the story that, from my point of view, I mean, we'll see what the audience thinks, but like it brings variety and it just tells a specific moment of like what Matt is going through, and it's just not one single thing.
What you both are talking about are like these moments, because our main character is blind, and there are moments where his other senses pick stuff up. I remember there's one shot, I couldn't tell you which episode it was in, but it's like where like it looks like a lens flare lands right on his ear right when he's hearing something, and I was watching that, and I'm like, is that visual effects? I think that's just a lens flare. I couldn't tell, but like, what, you know, like, what's the process of even coming up with, like, you know, because you're in a visual medium, but you're showing how someone uses their senses besides their eyes. How do you come up with those ideas?
Yeah, I mean, it was important to me, and I think both of us for sure, that it was something analog. Like, I'm really excited about getting it in camera and not having it be a VFX.
That a lens flare? Was that a real lens flare?
It was, yeah. There was a
certain. Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, we aimed for that, you know. Yeah, so it was like
it's a really cool effect, but I'm like, wow, that's like that would be so hard to do, I would think.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, and it was exactly as you described. It's something analog that sort of just felt like this little heightened moment, but it was sort of subtle, you know, and all captured with lensing and with camera. And then the sensory grande, which we now call it, is it was the big effect that's in the pilot that Justin and Aaron, the pilot directors, brought forth when they jumped on board, which was essentially a three camera rig with a long spherical zoom in the middle of the rig. Mm. It had to be spherical because there was an aspect ratio change. And then we had the flanking cameras on the rig be like wide angle primes. And so what we ended up doing was stitching together almost like a sort of like 180 or 270 degree view to sort of like hone in his senses, like he's tuning a radio dial, and that's kind of what he picks up on, is that one moment. So that was a combo of VFX and something really analog, which was like, okay, at least it had a real analog element to it. But I think it's totally, you know, it was something that was really worth it to do, and it only happens rarely, so it was cool.
It reminds me of something that Larry Fong did in 300 when they were doing the slow motion zooms in and zooming around, and it's like the technology was just new enough to do that kind of thing. Was that any kind of inspiration? I see you nodding. So did I call it?
Yeah, I've seen it. We did talk about that, actually, and it was something that was combined with that and then something the directors had done on another project that hadn't worked. And so it was cool that we all got to kind of like bring something forward that was like, hey, let's try this again and let's evolve it. So it was all about like, you know, just learning from stuff we tried before and evolving it that way.
That's so cool. That's really cool. So what was your the two of you like, what was your communication like? Since you're, you know, I guess you're doing them in basically two episode blocks for the most part. So, you know, like I feel like Hillary, you know, in doing episode one, you're kind of setting the look moving forward. So, you know, like all those kinds of decisions, the way it's lit, which is very, very low key in so many scenes, like that's all kind of set in place. How much the two of you communicate, like Pedro, when you're shooting an episode, if you're like in pre-production thinking about doing something, do you ever bounce it off of Hillary? The two of you talk a lot while you're doing it to make it one of a piece?
Yeah, I feel like I think opposite to other shows that I've done with other DP, I think the communication was pretty solid, and we were like constantly, you know, because our schedules are pretty nuts, so we're trying to find, you know, a way to connect, you know, after set, you know, like after hours, like quick phone calls, like, hey, this is what happened, like, you know, and at some point, you know, after something's established and like we know like what the show's direction is going to be, like, then, you know, you go into your own episodes because, you know, Hillary might be shooting and I'm prepping my own thing. So at that point, we're like on our own trying to, like, you know, put all these fires down and curveballs. So, yeah, it was a constant collaboration throughout the show, especially, I mean, before and after the strike, and after the strike too, because there was like some scenes that, you know, had to reshot or included Hillary episodes. So I have to, like, you know, talk to her about, you know, is there anything I should know? Anything, you know, like we're doing different, or you want something to, you know, make it feel specific for your episode. So it was a constant communication throughout, and with the team too. You know, like the camera team and the G&E team, the gaffer and the Kiri were like always, because they stay throughout the show. Like we alternate, but they're like pretty solid, like throughout on set every day. So also that was like my support as well. You know, when I needed something, I was like, hey, how do we do this? And they were like super supportive about everything.
Yeah, we had an amazing team. I mean, we're so lucky. And just like you're saying, it's like had to be a constant conversation because we were all sort of like, you know, a lot of the things carry through, like their themes and visual themes that carry through across multiple episodes. So we all had to be kind of on the same page. And but then also like doing the things that the interpretations we wanted to do on our own in our own episodes to sort of make it ours. But yeah, it all sort of had to be constantly in dialogue, and the crew was so good about maintaining that too, you know, like sort of saying like, well, we did this, you know, on the last episode, and it's something that really worked. And so, you know, it was just like an evolvement that was always happening. And that part's, for me, that was really exciting. You know, it's like you could never sort of like get bored or get kind of stagnant because you had to constantly be on your toes and be aware.
One of the cool things was like, you know, I think the team had an opportunity to like rewrite the show, but at the same time, they had an opportunity to like come back to us and say, hey, this is actually what we like of what was shot before. So for us as cinematographers, we're like, okay, this is great to know. It's a great feedback. So let's go more in this route. And also, you know, we incorporated other visual elements after coming back that surprisingly all fit again throughout the show, like, you know, so that was actually kind of cool to opportunity as well for us.
Like what kind of motifs or visual elements did you add in later that blended in? Like what were some of the later decisions?
I think you were talking about the flares, and that was something that came up in the meetings. They were like, you know, in the sensory moments with Matt, the team really liked the flair on those moments. So we're like, okay, let's try to look for those as long as they feel natural without forcing it. Right? And maybe Hillary, you want to talk about the rest?
Yeah, the flair is definitely for sure. It's like, you know, just things that feel really grounded and analog and kind of found was stuff that they liked. They liked the handheld, you know, they liked sort of the juxtaposition between Matt's world feeling a little bit more handheld and Fisk's world, which was more the institutional feeling on Dolly and studio mode, and having that feel a lot of wide angle close-ups, you know, more locked down. And so just like keeping those visual themes throughout, and that was something that was deep in conversation. And then something we brought new after the strike was certainly that sensory effect and some longer zooms. Like we did a lot more long zooms in the new pilot than we had done previously, and that sort of maintained throughout as well, like just some 70 zooms, which I'm always happy to do. Really fun.
It's so funny. I mean, I literally watched French Connection for the first time since film school probably last week.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah. And I was, yeah, I hadn't seen it in forever. And I was, I was kind of going down a Friedkin hole. And I can definitely see, you know, sort of that influence. And there's a certain kind of way that they used the zooms in the 70s that then fell out of fashion. And now I feel like it's just a style, like it maybe got overused in the 70s. And it's cool to see it in stuff now because it, I don't know, I forget who it was we had on here who said that like dollying in brings the camera closer to the actor and zooming brings the actor closer to the camera. Like, I always think about that when I see a zoom, like, I feel like I'm like moving into their world or something a little bit.
We had a term for it. We called them doom zooms, which is just like, you know, this impending doom that's certainly happening in the first season. You know, it's just all kind of relentlessly crushing down. And so the zooms are kind of doing the same thing. They're just pushing in. It's kind of targeting into one thing. It's not readjusting. Like, they're pretty just like relentlessly targeted. And so we had a certain speed that we did them on and a certain zoom, and they were just there to remind us of like this thing that's inevitable. It's kind of happening within New York and in the story.
And there was even in episode 4, I think, a pretty prominent, very well pulled off dolly zoom, like almost too well pulled off. Like, I'm like, how are you pulling it off that well?
Same. I was surprised. I was pleasantly surprised by that zoom and how it worked on the show. It was great. I remember watching the dailies on the pilot, Hillary, that scene, the courtroom scene with Bullseye, and you guys were like, it was like zoom all the way, like shot, reverse shot, and zoom, and it wouldn't stop. The camera wouldn't stop. Like, oh my God, how is this gonna, I was like, how is this gonna cut? Like, how are we gonna do this? Like, is this like what we're doing now? And then I saw an edit of that episode, and it's so great. I mean, it works so well. Like, cause if you see, you know, the dailies without the music, without the sound, without everything put together, you're like, it throws you off a little bit, especially after, you know, like we're mid show at that point. But you know, it was a great addition to the visual language, and I think it definitely made the show stronger.
Yeah, I think so too. I like it, and it adds a different element and texture, especially combined with the handheld, like the courtroom scenes that were very handheld and sort of like, you know, which brought a cool element of just like being with them during these scenes. It was just not like stock courtroom, you know, like we've all seen before.
I mean,
before.
That was the question I kept having while watching it, is like, how do you make courtroom fresh? Because we've all seen courtroom scenes a million, zillion, zillion times. And like, how do you bring it alive for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, Michael Cuesta is the director of those two episodes, the original pilot, then became episode 2 and 3. That was really something that he was very adamant about from the beginning. You know, he felt that it was all about getting with the characters and getting right in their faces with very wide-angle primes often. And, you know, I think it really worked. Like, I think there's something about those moments where it just brings it all forward and you're not just watching a trial unfold, you know, and especially, you know, once we sort of learn White Tiger's storyline and what's going to happen to him, you know, there's something just super present about just being very close to him during those moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess, you know, and obviously, you know, courtroom scenes are important for your main character because he is a lawyer, you know, like it's where it's going to go. I felt like that was an interesting move for the season again so far. I'm only up to episode 4, where it's like, wow, there's a lot more courtroom scenes than you would expect in, you know, a comic book adaptation. I also wanted to ask the two of you about the use of color, because it felt to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but it felt like there's kind of a general desaturation, a slight desaturation until we get into the intense stuff. And I started noticing, like, we're in a bar and there's like glasses of colorful drinks are put on the bar or whatever. And I felt like color, what was color a signifier of for you two?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think that, like, especially coming from some 70s references, you know, we sort of toned it down, made it a little bit more desat, and then the color you sort of earn, you know, certainly the red for Daredevil that grows as the series is going to progress, you know, is him returning to his character. White being a big color for Fisk, you know, obviously his iconic suit and what his character's known. So it was So in the DI, definitely it was intentional to kind of, you know, bring that saturation forward at certain moments and evolve it. And I think ultimately it's going in that direction and having a visual arc that will land there. So the moments that you mentioned, it's like they're planted intentionally to sort of say, like, this is where it's going to go, where it's going to end up.
Is that an idea that you're coming up with in the DI, or is that something that you planned from the beginning? Like, okay, we're going to be in the scene. We're going to have more red. We're going to have red wallpaper on the wall. Like, is that in concert with production design and wardrobe and everyone? Is that how pre-planned are those moments?
Yeah, they're definitely planned. I mean, Michael Shaw, our production designer, is incredible, a great collaborator, and he's always clocking that stuff, and it is very, very intentional. Specifically, the use of red was very carefully placed, at moments, and I think there's none in Matt's apartment, and like it sort of starts showing up in his world at different times. And we also did something that happened once post-strike too, was the use of a lot of interactive lighting, more so than when we started. And so mm-hmm. a lot of like headlights and taillights, and even the use of taillight red is sort of very specific. So there's just sort of like ways to find it occurring naturally, in quotes, in the world, and then also very intentionally placed within the design. So
I remember also the use of cooler daylight for Fisk. You know, like his office is such a place for him. You know, like there's so many scenes in his office, and remember that hard cool light that kind of like, you know, when together with that monochromatic feeling of Fisk.
Yeah, oppression, just like, you know, just make it feel very, very oppressive. Yeah, totally.
No, I know you're using anamorphics, but like, are you using specific lenses for specific people, or like what was kind of the operating theory about lens choice?
We have hours, I hope, to talk. No, just kidding. This is a long answer. But
I'll take it. No, this is what I want.
I think we both could probably geek out on this. We shot a G-series anamorphic primarily. Those were sort of our hero set. We had some T-series as well, Panavision lenses, Panavision primes. Certainly there was like a G40, I think, was our go-to. Like, we love that sort of like wide close feeling on Fisk specifically. It was slightly below eye line. That was like sort of his go-to.
What size sensor? I'm sorry to interrupt, but what size sensor?
35. Alexa, okay. 35. Yeah. Great. Yeah. I think the G40 and the G60 were some of our two heroes. Yeah, and we also have this lens called a MAP 55, which is a macro anamorphic, which is this sort of like really weird unicorn beautiful lens, which is able to get super close focus as well as just be a very like kind of like present soft vintage anamorphic prime. And we use that often too because it was able to get us very close for an anamorphic lens, but also sort of have the presence of a wide lens as well, because it's only a 55. So we got very lucky. Panavision spoiled us with our glass.
I mean, you know, I often hear that like anamorphic is great, but it's going to take you a lot more time, or you're going to need to use a lot more light. Were there any downsides to going anamorphic on this that like cost you in terms of time? Not saying it wasn't worth it, but
not for me, no. I mean, the G-series are fairly small primes, which was certainly helpful, but I feel like it's worth it, you know? It's worth the effort. It's worth the extra stop you have to light, too. It's, you know, it just, the result is so great. So, yeah, worth the trouble.
I feel with this sensitivity of the new cameras, it's not like back in the day when you're shooting film and you have 500 ISO and anamorphic, you know, like tons of light. Like now, you can just pump it up and still, you know, lighting super minimal with LED. I mean, we did have, you know, like 18Ks, 10Ks, whatever, all that, the big boys, but it's just not, it's not taking longer on set to light it because we have anamorphics, and we gotta talk about the team because, you know, it's just like a regular show or regular movie. If we were shooting sphericals too, I never had to like address that part of you know, the show.
Really, like, it has the technology just come so far that that anamorphic is literally just an aesthetic call and a budget call, I guess, but that it, like, it's not gonna, it doesn't slow you down at all.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, availability certainly is a bit of an issue sometimes. Yeah. You know, they're harder to find. But yeah, I mean, we were lucky in that way. I think, you know, like Peter's saying, like the sensor being what it is and sort of our ability to be able to light up, you know, like we were able to do that. I think it, you know, it really didn't slow us down. That said, a little asterisk is the zooms. The slow, long zooms were just what they are. They're slow and long. So that was a bit of a challenge. And we did shoot them over cranked often. So that, it was just like challenge on top of challenge. But again, worth it. You know, it's just like putting our heads, our all of our focus into something to really make it great. So,
and another thing that caught my eye while watching it was it felt like it almost felt like a Tony Scott kind of a vibe, where there is a lot of like exterior light was overpowering whatever interior light was in even courtroom scenes. Like it felt like the exterior, like the window light was really blowing us out in a good way. And I was curious if that was like, sometimes DPs will tell me that it's like, well, that gives actors more freedom to move around in scenes. But also it just kind of creates a vibe. Like it did remind me of a lot of very cool Tony Scott movies like True Romance and stuff like that, where I feel like the exterior light is kind of overwhelming. But was there kind of a creative impetus behind that choice?
Yeah, I mean, I think just in general, a harder light's kind of more interesting to look at in environments like that. It sort of gives you these nice ratios of contrast where they can move in and out of that really hard, bright light. It's also something interesting to play with, just, you know, Matt being blind and having it really not bother him, just sort of like an aspect to him where it gives him an advantage. And we talked, it's not totally related to the hard daylight, but his apartment being dark, you know, never having to turn a light on because he doesn't need to, you know, and just using light and environments in that way to sort of like to help mirror his experience. But the courtroom in particular, I just felt like it was a way to kind of show that space in a less, you know, typical way, like, you know, not just like overhead soft sources or soft daylight. It was just kind of like nowhere to hide in that moment. It just kind of comes in. It's very crushing and present. So
in my experience, I feel like there's a tendency of doing a lot of soft lighting nowadays. And my experience on the show was like very interesting, which was like, let's take the hard light and make it interesting, especially because these two actors can take it. You know, obviously when we went, you know, with like our female actresses, we were, you know, taking care of them and we're not lighting them the same as we're lighting Vincent D'Onofrio, but he can take it. You know, he can take hard light, front light, back light, anything. And it makes... it goes with the character and it goes with the story. It's like now, especially in it, like now he's a major, right? Like he's a New York City major. He's in the spotlight. He's like, he's still a mobster, but he's like there and the light is there and it's coming from underneath. It's coming from above. It's coming, it feels like it doesn't escape him. And, you know, that fight scene with Adam at the end, that he goes and sits down inside the jail, inside the cell, and the hard light is there finding him even in the most underground, you know, like dark basement. It's there. And to me, that element of using the hard light nowadays, which is again like it's you don't see a lot of shows using hard light, especially for the background, but not to light actors. And that was really interesting, you know, and refreshing.
Yeah, and very comic book. You know, we had a lot of talks about how we could, when we could reference a comic book. We had a lot of keyframes we were looking at. And just as you're saying, for sure, like, Vincent in hard light is the coolest image. He just can really take it. His face, you know, his shape, like, all about it. It just immediately, I felt like every time it happened, we're like, oh, there it is. There's Fisk, you know, like, it totally manifested.
So much gravitas in that role and owns it so well. I was kind of wondering, because like light is a character in this in a cool way, and a lot of times it isn't.
I think bolder choices, the fact that if it is a trend and people are making those bolder choices, that's great. You know, the cameras can handle it, the sensors can handle it, so we should be doing it. You know, I don't know, that's kind of my instinct always, is just to kind of go bolder if we can, push it as far as we're allowed to. So
So I feel like I have to ask about the big Wonner fight scenes, especially that one in episode one, which is just, I think, up there with some of the best scenes that have ever been done in a Daredevil show. I mean, that like up the stairs and onto the roof. And a lot of times when you're watching a Wonner that's not really a Wonner, it feels stitched, but that one really didn't feel stitched. It felt, when you talk about French Connection, it really did feel like you were kind of in a Friedkin almost documentary looking moment through that whole scene, but just, you know, the human body could not possibly do what the camera was doing there. Can you talk about the construction of that? Like, how do you go about constructing a scene of that complexity? And in television, you're always pressed for time. I don't know how pressed for time you were, but like, you know, you got to have those scenes in this show. It's Daredevil. You got to do this. How do you, where does it start? Where do you come in? Like, do they choreograph the fight and then you come in, or are you part of it through the whole thing? How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge effort. Obviously, everybody, you know, all departments, and starts with the writing. You know, they wrote this incredible scene. It was very cool. And Phil Silvera, who's our stunt coordinator, who came on post-strike, who was from the original show, he choreographed this incredible Wonner. And it was just like a super exciting thing to be able to be like, okay, we're going to do it. And, we rehearsed it both on stage and then on location. So the bar is all practical. That was a practical location. You know, the concept was that it was sort of this, like, again, this kind of like unrelenting camera move that was just observing. So everything had to be sort of shot wide for the most part, and it's all very practical. You know, they come through the window, there's lighting gags, all of that's very practical, just as the camera just observes. And then the first stitch is through the wall to go up the stairs. That was on the same location, actually. It's just that there was no door where we needed there to be a door. So that's the first stitch. And then the stairway is actually the section I'm kind of weirdly most proud of, because it was very, very small and practical and hard to work in. And
it looked like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it is exactly what it looks like.
I'll never know if it was all, you know, you shot it in a volume or whatever, but like, right. That's how it felt.
Totally. It was just a stairway in a building in Greenpoint and Brooklyn. And, so the camera operator is walking backwards up the stairs with the camera. There's lights that are blowing out, you know, the two actors are performing. And then the next stitch is going onto the roof, which was on stage. And the same kind of camera move that just, you know, relentlessly goes backwards and kind of watches it. And then the final stitch is just the tilt down to the street, which again was on location for the bar. What I think is so cool about it is that, you know, Charlie and Wilson, the two actors, did a lot of it themselves. There's obviously stunt doubles too, but they really did a lot of, like, those close moments are all them, yeah. Obviously, but, you know, they just did the physicality in a way that made it feel, for me, very, very real. And I think that, you know, they did, VFX did an incredible job. Like, everyone was sort of all hands on deck to make this work, and it took a lot of planning. And Phil was instrumental in it, you know, he and his team. So
yeah, so when it's first presented to you, you know, like take me back to the beginning. Is it like just written out in the script? How many of the beats of that fight are written in the script? And then when you start working with the stunt coordinator, are they like showing you storyboards? Are they showing you action figures? Do they do previs? Like, how do they build that so you can even start to do your job and figure out how to light and lens what they're doing and make it work as a Wonner, which, you know, in and of itself is, I'm sure, you know, so much coordination has to be done. So like, how is it presented to you?
Yeah, so it starts out as there's some storyboards that exist sort of like pre and post action sequence, and then the action sequence is pre-viz. So Phil and his team will shoot a video, which is actually like very detailed. You know, they had the smoke effects in there, they had some of the lighting effects in there, all stuff we had talked about. Like, we discussed having a strobe effect in the hallway, we discussed like when the sources will blow out. Yeah.
It's pre-viz, like it's computer graphics, right?
Yeah, but I mean, they do it themselves, which is, yeah, is very cool. So they're doing like kind of like basic VFX on their own previs, just to give, you know, the goal is just to give everybody, all departments, and of course Marvel, the chance to sort of approve it and see it and weigh in, and then discuss what we need to pull it off. So So yeah, they really lead the charge, and then we talk about, okay, could this be slightly modified to make it more possible? Could this be this lens? I mean, the challenge for that one in particular was had to be the same lens throughout, since it's a stitch and since it's kind of like one camera move, so to speak. So the lens that works in the bar is more challenging in the stairwell and then works again on the roof, you know. So sort of finding that perfect way of blending all the scenarios together, and then also matching all the lighting, of course, too. Even though there's things that are happening, we have to feel like it's all in the same environment. So yeah, it was a lot of conversations, but it all really started from that previs video that Phil was able to make, and then we would all react to. And we'll also say our VFX team is amazing, and they are a big part of it as well. And they're very detail oriented, and always the battle is we like to use atmosphere and practical haze, and they, of course, presents a challenge for them. So it's always a conversation of like, how much can we do practically? How much is better if VFX takes it over? And, you know, I think we're both we prefer practical. I think most DPs do. So, you know, it's always a conversation.
I think that about wraps up our time. Before we go though, where can people find you? Obviously we want people to go to Disney Plus and check out Daredevil Born Again, but where can people find you if they want to see your work online? Let's start with you, Pedro.
I have a website. It's my full name, Pedro Gomez Milan, with two L's at the end, Milan, and I have an Instagram, Pedro G Milan. Mostly there. I'm trying to be more active with a social thing, but
Hillary, what about yourself?
Same goes for me. I have a very not updated website, which is just hillaryspira.com, and then I believe that my Instagram is also hillaryspira too, but I am equally bad at updating it. So we're just out there in the world making stuff, you know.
No, you don't need to update it when you're working this hard. Well, yeah, I mean, and I really think that the thing we want everyone to do is just, if you have Disney Plus, but anyway, yeah, absolutely check out Daredevil Born Again, you know, a really fitting follow-up to the original series, and such a unique show in and of itself. So thank you both for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. This is a blast. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Ben.
All right, so that was Hillary Spira and Pedro Milan. Thank you both so much for coming on the show. Can't wait to finish the series. By the way, it's still going. I did the interview, only episodes 1 through 4 had dropped, so I'm still going through it. But yeah, just great work. Can't wait to see where it goes.
And now, short ends.
Yeah, terrific. So Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's a time we talk about our pet obsession. Do you have a pet obsession this week? What are you all about?
I watched it feels weird to call it an old movie because I, you know, was a fully grown adult when it came out. But for some reason, I was going through Tubi the other night. It's a long story. Like, I had a plan that fell through and I'm like, have a couple hours to kill. Maybe there's a movie on here. And I came across one that I actually own on digital, you know, that I have on physical media. But as we all know,
you can say VHS. No one will judge you.
It's not VHS. It's DVD, actually. But it's Steven Soderbergh's The Limey, which was shot by Ed Lockman, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Holy crap. I hadn't seen that movie. I saw it in the theater in 1999 when it came out. I had not seen it in years. And that movie is everything. I think it's definitely one of Soderbergh's best. You know, we have Soderbergh on the mind because he had Presence and then Black Bag come out within a month of each other. Mm-hmm. And he's probably the most prolific retired filmmaker who ever lived, because he just keeps on going. But The Limey, starring Terrence Stamp and Peter Fonda, Leslie Ann Warren. It has everything in it. Also, Louis Guzman is amazing in it. And I forgot how good that movie was. And if you want to see, like, what is genius shooting, what is genius editing, like the way that the dialogue scenes, I was reading a little thing about it, like trivia about it. And they were saying that, like, Soderbergh was offended that someone said, you can film someone talking, but you can't film them thinking. And so he has tons of stuff in this movie where he's cross-cutting dialogue scenes where it's like someone was with someone all day and we're pulling just all the dialogue about this one thing. But like a lot of times it'll be a shot of Terrence Stamp and you'll hear his voice come in. You think it's a reaction shot, but it's him thinking about something. And then it jump cuts to him talking. And it's gorgeous. And I remember reading in American Cinematographer, I want to say, that Ed Lockman did this effect for some of the flashbacks where he put the pull-down claw mechanism out of sync with the shutter. So what you get is like these cool vertical streaks. It's very impressionistic. So it's like, so, and it's very filmic. And they use it a lot. The cast is freaking amazing. And, you know, if you want to see why Soderbergh is the genius that he is, he's made a lot of great movies, but I feel like this one's very idiosyncratic. You know, Terrence Stamp as the lead is like brilliant and brutal and vulnerable all at once. It's it's a noir film. It's a straight up noir film but shot in like bright Southern California. Like everything is like overlit and just a wonderful film and worth revisiting or visiting if you've never seen it before.
I've seen it. And I gotta say, I saw it in the theater and didn't like it, and I have never revisited it. And now that you have spoken about it in such a heavy-handed, lovingly, you know, beautiful,
heavy-handed.
Yeah, you have you love it heavy-handed. Like this is not.
I do.
This is not. No, like, this is not like a passing, fleeting love story. You love this movie. I feel like, you know what? And you and I have talked about this. Like you've gone to a movie and you went like, God, that thing didn't work for me. And I go, oh my God, this is incredible. And then later you're like, I don't know what I was thinking. That was great. And then so maybe it's like that for me with The Limey. Maybe I need to go back and see it again. Maybe I was in a bad funk or something. The movie remember not working at all. And I remember
it's on Tubi. Check it out.
I mean, Soderbergh, and I feel like, you know, most of his things are hits for me, but that one was a rare miss. I'll try it again. I'll try it again for sure.
I mean, like it's one of those things too, where it's just like you forget about what an amazing actor Terrence Stamp is and how engaging he is on screen. And, you know, these days you don't often have, you know, basically an old man revenge movie. That's what this is. This is, you know, before you had Taken. you had this where, you know, Terrence Stamp plays a guy whose daughter died under mysterious circumstances while dating a much older man played by Peter Fonda. And he comes out to figure out what happened. He knows he smells a rat. And it also involves a bunch of film. They have a bunch of flashbacks of him as a young man. And it's taken from a Ken Loach film that Terrence Stamp was in like the late 60s. So the flashbacks are of young Terrence Stamp.
Nice.
It's really, I don't know. I think it's really effective, and I think it's one of Soderbergh's best. And you can't go wrong with Ed Lockman, one of the best DPs like ever. So,
yeah, for sure.
Anyway, so Ilya, what is your short end this week? What are you all about?
Well, my family has started binging an Apple TV series, which I turned up my nose at before, which I shouldn't have. And in my own defense, I thought it was something else. I really didn't know what it was, but I heard people talking about it. I never got into it. And it's called Mythic Quest. Mythic Quest is Rob McElhenney, and it's the story of a video game company. It's a little bit like The Office, not exactly, but it's a little bit like, something that takes place inside of a company, and there's interesting characters. It's a comedy. They venture off into surreal and fantasy quite often, and it's just a solid, really, really solid show. As I started watching it here, I wasn't sure what to expect, but the performances are all top notch, and it's shot really well, I should say, by Mike Berlucci. He shot, it looks like, most of the first couple of seasons, or first three seasons. But as I was going through then the IMDb to see who else is on here, there's a couple of people I know who shot episodes of this, which I thought was really cool. So I have stuff to look forward to as I get further into the series. So like, yeah, Mark Carter I went to film school with. He's shot 12 episodes. Matt Garrett, a client of Hot Rod Cameras, he shot an episode. So it's like there's other people here too. So I'm excited about the series, and I'm excited where it's going. The show appears to have started in 2020, just prior to the shutdown, and they work the shutdown of the pandemic into the show in such a clever way that that's basically where I'm at right now. I just finished the first season, just started season two, but like, I gotta say, they did it as well as any show I've ever seen, and it's really, really smart. So if you're looking for a smart and funny, you know, low-stakes show, you could do a lot worse than Mythic Quest. Mythic Quest has got some great stuff. I highly recommend it. And episode two is sort of like, it's almost like this red herring. It takes you off this whole other way. And it's a fantastic episode. I don't want to spoil it. If you haven't tried Mythic Quest, if you like shows that are funny and similar to, like, you know, I would say The Office, for lack of a better descriptor, or maybe It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, then Mythic Quest is for you.
Excellent. I'll definitely check it out. I have not watched it yet.
All right. So, Ben, that does it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch?
You can go, you can find me on benrock.com, best place to go, but you can also find me on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, X, and Blue Sky. I'm on Blue Sky quite a bit, but like, LinkedIn's pretty easy. If you want to talk business, work kind of stuff, I've actually been kind of gussying up my LinkedIn profile lately, so come check it out. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Well, actually, this weekend, they can find us in Vegas. They can find both of us out at NAB. We're going to be doing a live version of this podcast twice. So I know that you're gonna do one and I'm going to do one, I think is what it is right now. Or maybe we're going to do one together. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, if you are out at NAB and you would like to see this podcast happen in front of your own eyes, we're going to be over in the West Hall on Sunday.
Watch the magic unfurl.
We're going to be in the West Hall. There's going to be a live Q&A with the viewers, the people in the audience. And Alice Brooks.
Alice Brooks.
Alice Brooks is going to be on the Wicked, show. From yeah. Wicked. Yes. You know, she's going to be there. And then we're also going to, on the following day, so I guess that is Monday.
Monday.
Yeah. Monday afternoon, I'm going to be interviewing Adam Bricker, you know, DP of Hacks. So, yeah, fantastic. If you guys are out in Vegas and you want to come see the podcast happen, please check us out.
It does. Or if you see us wandering around, just say hi.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
You could do that too. I'm also going to be in booth N2819 with the new Betty products there. So I'm going to be hanging out. You can come say hello.
I'm sure I will visit that booth, but I won't be like working the booth.
So Ben, who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible?
As always, Alana Cody, who's kicking all the ass and dealing with a lot of logistics around Las Vegas. Holy crap. She produces every episode of this, and she just does such an amazing job. And we've gotten so many wonderful people on the show thanks to her and her diligence. We got to thank our editor, Charlie Nix, who's making us not hopefully sound like idiots too much.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm okay if I sound like an idiot, because I'm not like, you know, you're a technologist. Like, you have to sound smart. Me, no one cares what I think about this stuff. And if they do, they shouldn't. And and last but not least, Kay Zalatrakshi, our composer who composed all the music that you hear on this podcast. Check him out at musicbykays.com. Hire him to compose your next score. He's great.
Perfect. All right. So, Ben, I'm just going to take us out. Thanks for tuning in.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.